Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, December 20th, 2018. I expect this is my final podcast of the year. However, I live close to the secret studio, and if big news breaks while I'm on my break, I'll stop by and dish out a podcast for you. Especially if that fine fellow who is the acting Attorney General, Matt Whitaker, pulls some sort of a Saturday night massacre relative to the Mueller investigation. So as we head into the break, Congress is feverishly trying to finish work that, it's been dilly-dallying on all fall. And, of course, the brinksmanship over funding for Trump's border wall myth is not coming together. And after signals surfaced from the Republicans that there won't be a shutdown Friday night, well, Trump left some ambiguity in it today, and frankly, I'm tired of the bullshit, and we'll just wait and see if it actually happens. But the real important news is that in the Senate, as they're trying to wrap up business and complete a bill that will punt the budget issues and not shut down the government into early next year, there's been a remarkable debate about a bill I bitterly oppose. It is drafted by Ben Cardin of Maryland, a nominal Democrat, and Rob Portman of Ohio, who claims to be a Republican. And it is called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, Senate Bill 720. And they're trying to attach it to a must-pass spending bill, and they're trying to avoid any real debate on the issue. And so I was stunned to learn just before showtime today that my aging and very senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, has joined forces with Bernie Sanders of Vermont to challenge the constitutionality and the fundamental wisdom of this really bad proposal. And I commend Senator Feinstein. I'm often very critical of her. I felt that she should have retired instead of running for re-election this fall. And we've got to be very clear that neither Bernie Sanders nor Dianne Feinstein is taking a totally courageous stand here. They are properly interpreting the Constitution and their oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution. But a real act of courage would be for Bernie Sanders to say, you know, I support boycott, divestment, and sanctions toward Israel until the state of Israel changes its policies. That's not what Bernie is saying, and I want to be very clear about that, because in his letter that he co-authored with Dianne Feinstein and sent to Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, the respective leaders of the Senate, they explicitly said they don't support BDS, but they recognize that this is unconstitutional. Quote, while we do not support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, we remain resolved to our constitutional oath to defend the right of every American to express their views peacefully without fear of or actual punishment by the government. Now, in this era, where both parties are captive to Israel and its American arm, AIPAC, it is somewhat courageous that they're willing to separate themselves and stand for my constitutional rights. An additional quote from the Sanders-Feinstein letter, U.S. legal protection to the very settlements the United States has opposed as illegitimate and harmful to the cause of Israeli-Palestinian peace for more than 50 years. What they're referring to there is that there are some people who say, well, you know, it's okay to criticize Israel over the settlements, but not over what most of us believe is the apartheid policy that it continues to impose on its Palestinian neighbors. And the legislation, as it is written now, it's been amended several times, still would leave violators liable to criminal financial penalties of up to $1 million. And this is a clear carve-out of the First Amendment, saying falsely, that criticism of the policies of the State of Israel is somehow anti-Semitic. And while rationally we know that is not the case, it is a spun-up argument that appears to carry the day with many Americans who don't think carefully about these issues. Now, the New York Times wrote an editorial about this, published 2 days ago, on the 18th. And while, again, they are standing for my constitutional rights, it is a really hemming and hawing kind of editorial. It's pretty weak. But, nevertheless, it does oppose Ben Cardin and Rob Portman's bill. It says the aim is to cripple the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which has gathered steam in recent years. And there is hypocrisy in the way this bill is being described. Because they say, don't worry, you know, there are no criminal penalties, just fines on organizations and corporations. But it is defined by its supporters as a way of crushing the BDS movement. And you can't have it both ways. We say, this is very narrowly crafted to you. That's not true. And the Times correctly says that the Israel Anti-Boycott Act is clearly part of a widening attempt to silence one side of the debate that is not in the interests of Israel, the United States, or their shared democratic traditions. Hey, what about my First Amendment rights, gray lady? Well, they also say, look, the Palestinians are criticized when they resort to violence. Should they be deprived of nonviolent economic protest as well? Well, I think that's a good argument. So I am pleased to see this very late-breaking action in the U.S. Senate, and it remains to be seen how many Republicans out of the majority will break ranks to support my constitutional rights, and even how many Democrats will align with Sanders and Feinstein, recognizing that this is, at its heart, an unconstitutional measure. And credit to Glenn Greenwald. I've been trying to get to this story all week. I complained on Monday, there is so much to cover. And I've had a hell of a time deciding, you know, what to include in the podcast, and maybe I'll get this in tomorrow. So I've linked to Greenwald's piece at The Intercept about the case of the woman from Pflugerville, Texas, who has been teaching for years as a speech pathologist and therapist at a local grade school. Her name is Bahia Amawi, and she's the only employee in the district who speaks Arabic. But this year, when her contract came up, she was asked to affirm that she would not boycott Israel during the term of her contract of employment. And she said, well, you know, I'm a Palestinian-American. I have 4 kids. I have relatives in the West Bank. I don't consider myself an activist, but I do avoid buying products from Israel. This is a personal choice, she said. I'm always aware of the products and where they come from. It's just a habit of mine. So she is a careful shopper. And she consciously decides where her dollars go and where they don't go. That is a fundamental right of any American. And she is now suing the school district and the Attorney General of Texas to fight for her rights. And while we're talking about Israel and the Palestinians, earlier this week, a report surfaced from BuzzFeed, and it includes a description from the Palestinian chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, of one of his 37 meetings with our Crown Prince, Jared Kushner. And in the 37th meeting, at the White House, he said it went like this. I tell him, Jared, the president is supposed to sign the waiver not to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Kushner, we're not going to sign. Erekat, what do you mean we're not going to sign? The president promised us in the White House that he would not take any step that may preempt or prejudge Jerusalem, not before negotiations. Kushner, it's our business. We will conduct our policies according to our interests. Erekat, look, if you do this, you will have disqualified yourself from any role in the peace process. Kushner, don't threaten me. Erekat, read my lips. You will have disqualified yourself from any role in the peace process. Kushner, you don't know the changes that are happening around you in the Arab world. Erekat, well, the best thing for me is to be a student, so teach me. Kushner, shouting, don't be sarcastic. Erekat, I'm not being sarcastic. What do you mean by changes? Do you think Arab countries will open embassies in Tel Aviv and accept Jerusalem with the Al-Aqsa Mosque as Israel's capital? To them, Jerusalem is a red line, all of them. Saudis, Qataris, Egyptians, Jordanians, Bahrainis. So what are you talking about? Kushner. This is our business, our policies. This is the guy who is supposed to have a secret peace plan. It's going to be crammed down on the Palestinians. But it's not ready for prime time. We've been told to expect it for years now. And it could be that the way Kushner has handled himself to date is a big part of the problem there. Now to yesterday's Twitter announcement by the president that U.S. forces will be withdrawn from Syria forthwith. And I find the reaction to this absolutely fascinating. I didn't hear any commentary. I watched the public television news hour. Rachel Maddow worked this story over. I've got quotes here from the New York Times and other outlets. Nobody is saying, hey, Trump recognized that Obama had blundered by putting U.S. forces into Syria, by playing a role in that conflict to begin with, and by imagining that our covert efforts could bring down both the Islamic State and the Assad government simultaneously. Nobody's talking about the idiocy of Trump of Obama's policy that Trump has mercifully put to rest. Now, I don't for a minute support the way Trump did this. It was an emotional outburst, probably driven by his desire to distract us from all of the other problems that he has, like the wall and Mueller. Nonetheless, I celebrate the announcement that U.S. troops could be withdrawn from Syria. Now, there are going to be all kinds of efforts to backstop this and prevent it from happening. And the fact that he overruled John Bolton and Mad Dog Mattis and the rest of his advisors, I think actually deserves a little compliment for Trump. And you know I'm loath to give him credit for anything. And, of course, his reasons could be all wrong. But overruling John Bolton, I think that's a good day in Washington, D.C., and I haven't seen anybody acknowledge that in any of the comments that I've read so far. And Marco Rubio, who loves a good war, said that this is a major blunder. If it isn't reversed, it will haunt this administration and America for years to come. And, of course, this makes idiots out of all kinds of people like Brett McGurk, who's running the Syria program for the U.S., and all of these other advisors who've been saying, you know, piously that, oh, we're going to be there for a long time. Like James Jeffries, State Department Syria envoy, told the Atlantic Council that the U.S. would stay in Syria until the Islamic State is defeated, Iranian influence is curbed, and there's a political solution to the Syrian civil war. And Trump just said, nah, never mind. Now, I realize there are consequences from this kind of impulsive action. It left the Pentagon, our allies, virtually everyone flat-footed. But I still stand by my position that we had to get out of Syria one way or the other. And I guess this is the other. And aside from longtime peaceniks like David Swanson, I'm not hearing anybody say, wow, we're taking a break from endless war? We're accepting that we had no positive influence in Syria and no business being there in the first place? And, of course, Vlad Putin, who is depicted as the guy who holds the leash on Trump, he held the decision, saying that Donald is correct. Now, that doesn't help domestic politics, but it doesn't mean that Putin is wrong. Now, whether you like Russia's role in Syria or not, Bashar al-Assad asked for help, and Russia delivered it. Nobody ever invited the United States to put 2,000 or 4,000, whatever the number is, of troops. Nobody invited the U.S. to support the covert operations, the myth of the Free Syrian Army and the moderate rebels. Nobody. It was unilateral. And to that extent, I agree with Putin. Oh boy, I'm gonna take a lot of shit for this. I can see the emails coming now. Oh, Peter, you Putin apologist. Can you think clearly? Can you hold more than one thought at a time? That's the challenge I offer you, friends. Now, meanwhile, I said yesterday that Trump's move could consign the Kurdish fighters who have been the stalwarts of the U.S. operation in Syria. They now are branded as Syrian Democratic Forces. It could lead to their slaughter by Turkey or by Syria. And the U.S. is just going to evacuate, retreat, and leave them there? Well, they say not so fast. We're holding on to 1,100 Islamic State fighters and 2,000 of their relatives. Should we release them? And that is a threat that I'm sure Trump didn't contemplate, because he doesn't read the briefings. He doesn't think about the unintended consequences. Now, we're told that the force called the Syrian Democratic Forces is now up to 75,000 fighters. They're not all Kurds, not all members of the YPG. But still, they are the odd men out. And I do fear a slaughter is in the near future. Now, to offset some of the emotional reporting in the corporate media, I turn to Consortium News, where Patrick Lawrence, a globetrotting reporter, reviews this and says, don't hold your breath. He said, just about everything in these initial reports is either wrong or misleading. One, the U.S. did not defeat the Islamic State, as Trump claims. The Syrian Arab Army, aided by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah militias, did. Two, hardly was ISIS the only reason the U.S. has maintained a presence in Syria. The intent for years was to support a coup against the Assad government, in part by training and equipping jihadists often allied with the Islamic State. For at least the past 6 months, the U.S. military's intent has been to counter Iranian influence. And he adds, the U.S. is not closing down its military presence in Syria. It's digging in for an indefinite period, making Raqqa the equivalent of the Green Zone in Baghdad. By official count, there are 503 U.S. troops stationed in Raqqa. Unofficially, according to the Washington Post and other reports, the figure is closer to 4,000. So, this is fascinating, and you don't hear these kinds of arguments or analysis in the corporate media. And one more quote here. The president can have all the foreign policy ideas he wants, but the Pentagon, state, the intelligence apparatus and the rest of what some call the deep state will either reverse, delay, or never implement any policy not to its liking. I think that's a dose of reality there. And we'll see if our dear tweeter prevails over the deep state in the long run. Malaysia has filed criminal charges against Goldman Sachs. And the company is also facing criminal charges in the United States all around the same issue, the fleecing of 1MDB, which is the Malaysian Development Berhad, which is the state investment fund. The people who ran it into the ground, siphoned off billions of dollars, and Goldman Sachs was there watching all along. So we're going to watch that case. But today I am releasing an in-depth interview, my last of the year, with Professor Peter Phillips of Sonoma State University. And his powerful new book with rich detail is called Giants, the Global Power Elite. And in this excerpt, Peter Phillips describes the couple of hundred people who have excessive control. These are the super connected asset managers at only 17 firms who represent the financial core of the world's transnational capitalist class. Here's Peter Phillips.
But as I was studying the NASDAQ investment policies for these giant investment companies, the ones that we were public, I started seeing they're all invested in each other. So we calculated the number, and we found out under NASDAQ investments, there was $400 billion. Those 17 companies had over $400 billion invested in each other, and that was just like a quarter of all their investments. So it's a giant network of capital with a small number of firms, all interconnected in one giant cluster of centralized control. It's very data-rich. 199 names, you know, with paragraphs about these people, all in 40 pages or 50 pages, sounds like, oh, I could just skip that. But the important thing is not to.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you read those 199 biographies, at the end you go, okay, I get it. These people are the same. They're wealthy. They have these positions of power. And they're running the world. Or the world runs for them. And governments are working on their behalf. So it is a insight into the global power elite that really hasn't been available to us at this level.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Peter Phillips. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher. And I hope you will check it out when you find time during your own holiday break. The book is fascinating, and as I say, it names names and it profiles how they are employed by one company and serve on the board of another, how these big firms are cross-invested in each other. It's a fascinating, revelatory book, and you can find it at the website of Project Censored, censored.org. And that's the best way to purchase that book. Every day I like to pause when I remember and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I want to thank Craig in North Bend, Oregon. He is a guy who chips in a few bucks when he has a chance, and I value his contributions as much as anyone else's. And the Postal Service here in San Rafael returned two of his recent letters to me. And I went and kicked some ass at the post office yesterday, and we have fixed the problem. So if you recently sent mail to me and had it returned, will you please try again? I apologize for the errors there in the return of mail. And, of course, my P.O. Box is Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California. The zip is 94915. And my last appeal of the year, it's time for you to take out a subscription. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page. You choose a level of support you're comfortable with. You got my mailing address if you're allergic to PayPal. I would really appreciate your generosity and support as we head into 2019. Trump took it on the chin from two federal judges yesterday, including the one who kind of went postal at the Mike Flynn aborted sentencing hearing the day before. That's Judge Emmett Sullivan in Washington. Now, Sullivan was appointed by Poppy Bush, and he, as you know, gave both Mike Flynn and the Mueller prosecutors a hard time at the hearing about sentencing the other day. Well, yesterday, he issued a blistering ruling rejecting the flawed rationale offered by former Attorney General Jeff Sessions regarding political asylum in the United States. And he said that when Sessions just unilaterally announced that you could not apply for asylum for domestic abuse and certain other situations, the judge wrote that this was arbitrary, capricious, and in violation of the immigration laws. Now, that's pretty strong language. And the judge issued a national injunction to back up his words. And here in San Francisco, the Trump administration saw the court overturn the rules that were announced on November 9th, banning asylum for anyone who entered illegally from Mexico outside the designated ports of entry. And District Court Judge John Tigger said that federal law allows no such limits, reaffirmed his conclusion in a preliminary injunction, noting that a federal appeals court had upheld his earlier order. Quote from Tigger, "It would be hard to imagine a more direct conflict between the law and the president's orders." So despite that, Trump Co. yesterday bullied the country of Mexico into accepting residents of asylum seekers who apply at our border and then are turned away. Now, this has been an effort for months by the United States and the new government run by AMLO, apparently buckled under pressure from the United States. But this does not comply with our own federal court interpretations of the jaundiced positions taken by the Trump administration. It's bizarre. Now, earlier this week, I reported to you, the New York Times reports, based on their analysis of Facebook and other information, which alleged that there was a Russian scheme that was very successful in manipulating African Americans in the United States. And as I pointed out at the time, they falsely connect what is perceived as lower turnout by African Americans as successful manipulation, when it was the voter suppression schemes aimed at black voters by Republicans that produced that reduction in participation by black voters. Now, the study that the Times relied on was in part provided by a company called New Knowledge. Now, tuck that away, because New Knowledge is the source of today's blockbuster report about how New Knowledge conducted secret experiments during the special Senate race between Doug Jones and Roy Moore in 2017. They spent $100,000 on a secret effort to use false Facebook ads. They created a Facebook page on which they posed as conservative Alabamians, using it to try to divide Republicans and even to endorse a write-in candidate to draw votes away from Roy Moore. It involved a scheme to link the Moore campaign to thousands of Russian accounts that suddenly began following the Republican candidate on Twitter, a development that drew national media attention. The report says, "We orchestrated an elaborate false flag operation that planted the idea that the Moore campaign was amplified on social media by a Russian botnet." Now, this was an effort to sow discord by Americans in an American election. And I consider this to be totally outrageous. And yet, this is treated as bad Russians, good Americans. And I hope it doesn't create some kind of backlash where Roy Moore can act as a victim, pull out the Ten Commandments, and somehow unseat this kind of worthless Democratic senator named Jones. We live in strange times. Here is a real report about fake news. The respected German magazine Der Spiegel has fired a reporter and editor named Klaus Relotius after discovering that he fabricated parts of at least 14 articles. And part of this was discovered because of people in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, where Relotius showed up to write a story about a coal plant employee. He made up the name of one of the people he quoted. He made up a slug on the sign on the edge of town. He made up a lot of stuff. And a couple of people who were just drinking coffee and reading Der Spiegel, I guess, decided to research the fake claims that he had made. And this apparently led Der Spiegel to discover further fabrications and fire his ass. And speaking of journalists who go sideways, I know Clara Jeffrey a little bit. She's one of the co-editors of San Francisco-based Mother Jones magazine. And Mother Jones has gone off the deep end on Russiagate. I don't read it much anymore. But Clara took to Twitter, to the Twitter machine yesterday, and she posted what she purported to be survey results from African-American women. And she says, you know, Kamala Harris is showing 71% support, Beto O'Rourke 38%, Joe Biden 25%, and Bernie's at the bottom of the heap here with only 12%. And then Clara says, Bernie's never going to be the nominee unless he turns those numbers around. Well, the Twitter fans pushed back and said, well, you know, only, less than half of the people in that survey identified as African Americans. And the sermon that you gave there is kind of offensive to black Bernie Sanders supporters. One tweet says, to show that Bernie lacks support among black women, Clara Jeffrey circulated a poll in which less than half of respondents were black women. All respondents were self-selected operatives, politicians, and donors. Expect a lot more of this junk. Well, we shall. More truth-telling about Beto O'Rourke. Now, I have to admit, like most people, I was seduced by his great campaign against Ted Cruz in Texas, which came up short by, about 2.5 points? And now Beto is seen as a contender for president. And to his credit, David Sirota has overcome the Twitter criticism of his former boss. I think she was his boss. Anyway, she currently runs the Center for American Progress, where Sirota worked when it was first opened back in around 2005, if I remember correctly. Anyway, I've linked to Sirota's piece. He shows that on critical issues to progressives like consumer protection and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, on issues related to fossil fuels and energy, immigration and criminal justice, that Beto O'Rourke has often voted with the Republicans. And one bill that is particularly annoying was it eliminated the polygraph requirements for people who want to work for the Border Patrol. And my old pal Luis Gutierrez, who I believe is retiring from his congressional seat in Chicago right now, he said anyone who votes for this bill is voting to support and implement Trump's views on immigration, his desire to militarize our southern border, and his fantasy of a mass deportation force. O'Rourke joined Republicans in voting for the bill. And so I don't demonize Beto O'Rourke. I want people to have an honest understanding of his record before you decide that he should be the Democratic nominee in 2020. As expected, the judges on district courts closed ranks to protect the one of their own who was elevated to the Supreme Court. As you may know, there were 83 complaints were filed against Brett Kavanaugh by lawyers, doctors, professors, and concerned citizens. And there's a process for filing these objections in a federal system. They go to the Judicial Conduct and Disability Act, and that doesn't apply to Supreme Court justices. So on that technicality, they have flushed away all of the objections to the demeanor that was displayed by Brett Kavanaugh, the accusations that he lied about his drinking, the open case of the allegations of Christine Blasey Ford. All that is just history, because the judges said so. Before I go, I want to acknowledge that new studies show a spike, a very troubling increase in the use of vaping, and the Juul Vape Company has just had a big investment from one of the big tobacco companies, the traditional tobacco companies. Research shows that 37% of 12th graders reported any vaping in the last 12 months. The rate of vaping nicotine in the last 30 days has doubled from 11 to 20%. The only good news in here is the rate of cigarette smoking among teens has dropped to 3.6%, the lowest reported, I believe, in history, or at least going back to 1975. And finally, I haven't heard a peep of objection, and there should be loud objection to Trump's decision to sign a document creating the ordering the Department of Defense to create a new space command. Now, we're told this is separate from his fantasy of a space force. But fundamentally, and this crept into view under Obama, who did not block any effort to weaponize space, we need to take a firm stand that our country will not weaponize the area beyond our earth. And these ideas by Trump should be shot down immediately and forcefully. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube. And yes, I dare say, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Holidays to all of my listeners around the globe. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.